Good afternoon, everyone. Appreciate you all spending your lunch hour with us today, and it's a great honor to be on this panel. My contribution today is going to be to talk about mental health as a human right. And the comments today are part of a longer project in trying to really define a human right to mental health as a discrete idea. Very often when people talk about human rights and how they apply to health, and in particular of the right to health, mental health is something that is either left out or paid very little attention to. And this is something that I'd like to bring more attention to, the important role of mental health in overall health and how human rights law and human rights norms can really be brought to bear to try to improve mental health. And so what I hope to do today is to set out generally what I believe is a starting place for thinking about mental health as a human right. And then also to talk about some of the legal provisions in human rights law that have been developing that I think can be useful in trying to use law as a tool to try to improve mental health across populations. And I'm talking about this in a global context, not just in the United States, but certainly many of these ideas are very relevant here as well as elsewhere. I may have neglected to put in my important slide about no disclosures, but I will say that I have no conflicts of interest, no commercial interest of any sort. And in that note, I should probably take this branded cup of coffee and put it back on the table. So, forget you saw that. I'm not endorsing their coffee, although it is quite good. So, to move on, I'm going to cover basically four things in this presentation. The first is going to be talking a little bit about the global burden of mental health and how different mental health problems prevail around the world in different contexts, and also how laws in many cases have not been adequate to try to address these problems. A second issue is going to be looking at some of the myths and misconceptions that have arisen around mental disabilities that have made it harder to achieve and protect human rights and harder to pass laws and enforce laws that might prevent these kinds of abuses from happening. A third area that I'm going to briefly address is how human rights laws and norms have really proliferated, particularly in the past few years, and in ways that really make it more likely that human rights to mental health can be protected. And finally, I'm going to make several suggestions about future steps to try to improve mental health using these kinds of human rights laws and provisions. So I think the place to start is to maybe get into a little more detail about what I mean when I talk about mental health as a human right. There really are two different ways that people have thought about this issue. And I will say there's not a whole lot that's been written on the first version here, which is actually looking at mental health as a subspecies of the right to health. There's been a lot of scholarship looking at, and also a lot of effort at the international level trying to develop what the right to health means, including General Common 14 to the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, and some other provisions as well. Mental health really hasn't received quite as much focus as other aspects of health, and that's probably not surprising, but it's something that I think leaves a big gap. And so one way to think about mental health as human rights, think about mental health as a subcomponent of a right to health, a piece of the right to health. I think another way to think about it, and perhaps a better way to think about it, is that a right to mental health is the combination of realizing a whole group of rights, including the right to health, right to life, right to participate fully in society, rights to vote, rights to fair trial, rights to adequate health services, et cetera, et cetera. And I'll talk a little bit more about this in detail later on in the presentation. But I think bundling a whole set of rights together and combining the effects of all of these human rights is really a better way to think about how to achieve a right to mental health and how to define a right to mental health. Okay, so very quickly, the global impact of mental and intellectual disabilities is quite significant. And I don't think these figures are widely known, although, I mean, these are from a well-distributed WHO report from 2005, but I don't think many people who work in public health who aren't specifically focused on mental health realize the magnitude of this situation, that there are 450 million people around the world who are estimated to have psychological, neurological, and behavioral and mental conditions. And so that's quite a significant burden. And if you compare that to other areas of public health concern, you see that the rate of morbidity is definitely in the top five, and depending on the survey, sometimes two or three on the list. Also, if you look around and you see what countries have done with regard to their laws, only 64% of countries do not have mental health legislation at a national level, or if they do have legislation, it's old legislation. It's legislation that was drafted more than 10 or 15 years ago. And old legislation is not necessarily bad legislation, but older legislation tends to not have taken into account the kinds of human rights approaches that have been developed more recently and have been more consistently incorporated into law more recently. And so those laws might lack in some of the kinds of human rights protections that that I think are relevant. And finally, this is pervasive all around the world. In most countries, mental health services are grossly underfunded, and this inadequate level of funding is really a huge impediment to achieving protection of human rights. Now, another important piece of this story is looking at some of the myths and misconceptions that surround mental disabilities. I've listed three of probably the most pernicious myths on this slide. And the reason that I think these are relevant is because the fact that there are these very broadly understood misconceptions about mental disability really drives law and policy, and also drives social perception. It perpetuates stigma against people with mental disabilities. It further marginalizes people because there are these beliefs that these situations are true. And let me elaborate on this a little bit. The first myth is the myth of incompetency. Many laws and many policies treat competency as an all or nothing proposition. And so once someone has their competency removed by a court or by an order, that removes competency for them to make a whole range of decisions about their life. In reality, competency is something that is variable. It fluctuates over time, and it exists along a continuum. And so there may be people who might have limited capacity in certain areas, but could still have competency to make decisions about their lives in other areas. And so to have an all or nothing provision where someone's competency is removed without any nuance is really a big human rights problem. A second area that I wanted to identify is the myth of dangerousness. Certainly there are people with mental disabilities who are dangerous, but it's a very small number of people. And yet there's a very prominent misconception that there's a higher rate of dangerousness among people who have serious mental disabilities like schizophrenia or antisocial disorder. Some of those people are dangerous, but most of them are not. And in fact, when you look at the data, people with serious mental disabilities are less likely than members of the general population to actually engage in dangerous activities and threats of harm to other people. And so, but unfortunately, very often when one of these circumstances occur where someone with a mental disability does commit a violent act, it receives a huge amount of attention. The media really gives it a lot of play. And so very often that influences not only social perceptions of people, but also legislation and the ways that we deal with policies that affect a much broader range of people who are actually not dangerous or not dangerous at all. Finally, the myth of deinstitutionalization. And I think I might need to rephrase how I state that, because I'm not saying that deinstitutionalization is a myth or even a bad thing. For those of you who are not familiar with the deinstitutionalization movement, in the 50s and 60s, with the discovery of effective psychotropic drugs, many people who used to be confined to psychiatric institutions were able to move out of those institutions and receive treatment in the community with effective medications. And this is a great advance in human rights, allowing people to have a greater degree of freedom and liberty and still receive the kinds of medications that they needed to treat their mental health conditions. The problem has been that most societies, and you know, there are a few exceptions, but most countries that went through this process actually didn't really fund these programs adequately, and as I mentioned a couple of slides ago. And so what ended up happening was people didn't have the means or the support to continue to take their medications out in the community. And many of these people were unable to benefit greatly from this newfound ability to live in the community. Many people ended up being rearrested and re-confined, but instead of in a psychiatric facility, in a prison, or in some other kind of confining institution where they might not even receive mental health care anyway. And so there's been this, in some cases, there's been a transmigration of people from psychiatric facilities to penal facilities where they're not receiving adequate care. Okay, so so just to summarize that whole first section, and I know my time is dwindling, so I'm going to speak a little bit faster. I hope no one runs. There's been the violations against people with mental disabilities continue to occur rampantly around the world, and policies and laws have been inadequate to protect human rights in these areas. I want to spend a few minutes of my time talking about what's happened in human rights law that I think gives some hope or some renewed enthusiasm about changing some of these situations. There have been a number of areas in which human rights laws have been strengthened in recent years. And most prominently, I want to mention the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, which just came into force in the past 2 years and really has some very important provisions. It has been widely signed and is in the process of being widely ratified by many countries. So that's probably the most important human rights development. I'm actually going to skip a couple of slides here. I'm going to come back to this one in a second. So basically what's happened, in addition to new international conventions and the actual formal legal frameworks that create human rights law at the international level, there's also been a development, a diffusion, if you will, of some of these human rights norms and principles into national laws. You see this in some national constitutions now, for example, explicitly recognize the right to health. That's something that really wasn't being done until the last 10 to 15 years. You see very sophisticated advocacy being brought by NGOs that advocate for human rights, and using regional human rights courts, the European Court of Human Rights, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, to create jurisprudence that actually helps to define what sorts of rights need to be protected. And in the context of mental health, you see a number of cases in these regional courts where there have actually been decisions finding violations of the right to health, of the right to life, of other human rights, in cases where people have been treated poorly or denied access to important services. And I wanted to go back for a second and identify five areas where I think there's particular human rights concerns, five substantive areas that the laws are beginning to address but have not quite adequately addressed. And I think this is a challenge for future work and for future advocacy as well, to try to ensure that all these areas are addressed and addressed from a human rights perspective. So the top two ideas on this slide, access to mental health care and protection of underlying determinants of mental health, are the kinds of provisions that you typically see associated with a right to health. And so not only should people with mental disabilities and intellectual disabilities have access to needed medications and needed services, and by the way, this should also be, unless it's impossible to do so, these services should be provided in a community setting that's less restrictive and can allow these people to live and fully participate in the community. But also, it's important to not neglect to include protection of the underlying determinants of mental health. All the things that we might try to encourage in society that fosters good mental health. So, for example, things like other social support, education, training, even the overall reduction of stigma in society is I believe, an underlying determinant that allows for, that can allow for better mental health. The final three substantive areas on this slide identify some specific human rights violations that still frequently occur around the world, including people being admitted to and detained in psychiatric facilities without adequate judicial review, without adequate medical justification, the failure to have adequate periodic reviews to ensure that someone needs to continue to be retained in one of these kinds of settings, And also, once someone is in an institution, whether it be a psychiatric institution or some other kind of institution, like a hospital or a prison, there should be standards in place. And many countries have these, but they're enforced to varying levels of success. Conditions of confinement must be adequate. They must be safe. There must be adequate food and water and lighting, adequate space to avoid overcrowding. Having access to healthcare services, including mental healthcare services, in these facilities that are tailored individually to each patient's need. And finally, civil rights, making sure that people with mental and intellectual disabilities have the opportunity to fully participate in society, and that includes being able to vote, being able to marry, being able to have a family. There are many countries that have laws that put severe impediments on this kind of, and many of these common activities of life, and these really need to be, these laws need to be changed in order to protect human rights. So I just want to finish with just one or two quick comments, because my time is up. Oh, I did put the disclosure. It was at the end, I'm sorry. So there are a couple of things that I think are promising. Well, I mentioned that there's been this proliferation of human rights, and I think that what it's created is actually a redundancy in the system. You have protections at the international level, you have protections at, in some countries, at the national level. And I think these multiple levels of protection is really a good thing. And I know typically in law we think of redundancy as being bad or confusing or problematic, not efficient. There might not be consistent standards. But I think in this case, when you're talking about protection of rights, having this redundancy is actually a beneficial thing, certainly for the short term. I think in the long term, moving towards more harmonization of protections is a beneficial thing. And finally, there has to be much more work done in this area, both empirical work and work in developing what the human right to mental health should mean in a very substantive way. And I think that work is ongoing, but really needs to be paid attention to and put forward in future efforts. So thank you very much, and look forward to your questions.